Proverbs chapter 29 and Proverbs 11 and Proverbs 28. I want to read three verses from each of these chapters. Proverbs 29:2 says this: "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn." Proverbs, hold your finger because we'll be coming back to chapter 28. Go to Proverbs 11 and verse 10. Proverbs 11:10. "When it goeth well with the righteous, the city rejoiceth. And wicked, when the wicked perish, there is shouting." And then Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 28. "When the wicked rise, men hide themselves. But when they perish, the righteous increase." I've titled the message this morning, "What Shall the Righteous Do?" We have experienced what I believe is a historic and an overwhelmingly successful general election this past Tuesday. There were many candidates that were defeated that needed to be. There were some least of evils reelected. I think specifically of Boehner and McConnell. Personally, I wouldn't have minded seeing either one of them dismissed as well. But there were a number of quality individuals who were elected and reelected also. I think of men like Tim Scott down in South Carolina, who we heard in Washington, D.C., when we were down there in March. And, I mean, he grabbed the Bible off of a pastor's lap on the front row and just preached to us. You know, and there's some good people that we have in office now. The Republicans now have control of both houses of Congress, an overwhelming and historic control in the House of Representatives. I think it's been 100 years since they have had this large of a majority in the House of Representatives. I looked at a map that shows the actual grid of who is where, and the blue is pretty sparse. You've got the West Coast, and even in those states on the West Coast, it's the very West Coast of those states that is basically blue. The rest is red of those. California and Oregon and Washington have a lot of red in it. It's just the coast. And then it comes down, and you get over to Arizona, and I believe it's the southern part of Arizona. It's kind of pretty much half and half, red and blue. New Mexico, it's the northern half of New Mexico that it's a blue, and the southern half is red. Then you go clear down to the tip of Texas, and it's blue with a couple of little splotches there. The rest of the map, it's just splotches here and there, except for Minnesota, which is pretty much all blue. And the eastern side of Iowa and the western edge of Illinois. The rest of it's red. And then you get up into the northeast, and you know most of Maine is red with a little bit of blue, and then the New Hampshire, Vermont, and Connecticut and Massachusetts are all blue, of course. And the rest is just blotches around. It's a sea of red. That's good. The Senate's, you know, a little bit closer, but still they've got a majority there. The Republicans do. You know, you look at this, the polls in many cases were wrong. All this emphasis on all who's going to win, projections of who's going to win, they were wrong. That woman in Kentucky who was against McConnell, it was supposed to be a tight race. It wasn't. The governor of Texas, Abbott, who won against the abortion Barbie down there, was supposed to be close. It wasn't. So these cold polls don't really reflect accurately what's going on. And you know, and when you look at the governor's races, Pennsylvania is the only state where a Republican governor lost re-election. It's the only state where the Democrats gained in the gubernatorial races. Every other time, every other case, and I forget how many there were, but there are a number of places where the Republicans again gained in the governor's house. But even with that, in Pennsylvania, we elected a greater majority. We already had a majority in both houses, but we elected a greater majority. There are 119 Republicans and 84 Democrats in the House, 30 Republicans and 20 Democrats in the Senate. So even though we have a Democrat governor, his hands are tied. In fact, I saw in the paper just this morning, there's an article that said insiders are telling Governor-elect Wolf that he needs to reach out to the other side. You know that that's something that Corbett did not do to his own party? He didn't work with his own party. Probably part of the reason why he lost. We might even be better off with Wolf in there than we were with Corbett. It's hard to imagine. But we look at this whole thing, and you know, and there's a lot to have hope about. And maybe not quite like the morning now in America that President Reagan ran when he was running for re-election, you know, pointing all the brightness and the things that were accomplished in his first 4 years as he was looking for four more years. But I think that there is some hope. And as again, as we came back from Washington last March and to see those who were already in office, Bible-believing Christians in office, and we have more now in going to Washington. That's good. In fact, I'm going to be in, I talked to Dr. Harding about this already. I'm going to be in contact with him about what we can do about maybe getting our representative, Glenn Thompson, more involved with the conservative people that we met and were introduced to down there when we were down there. But there's a lot of things to hope. And we can be pleased with the outcome that we have. But, of course, the question remains, what's going to be accomplished? Because sadly, in the past, the Republicans have very much disappointed me in accomplishing very little when they had the opportunity to do something. That's my one fear in all this, is they're going to shoot themselves in the foot again like they have in the past. But that said, I got this email this week from Chad Conley. He's a national director of the Republican Party in charge of faith engagement. And I've told you about him before. And here's what he writes. The results were incredible, but as I've said before, this wasn't a one-time deal. Our job is not over. Our plan is to make engaging the faith community an all-year, every-year operation. As we move forward into 2015, we will continue to build out our activities all across the country. And that means we will continue to, now watch this, we will continue to need to find other pro-faith conservatives who want to help us identify, educate, and engage others in their places of worship. And this to me is particularly encouraging because for the first time ever, a political party has set up a director who is specifically to reach out to conservative Christians. And I think that conservative moniker is important because too often times we've had the Boehners and the McConnells and the Susan Collinses up in Maine and the clowns like that who have been governed really no differently than the Deceptocrats that we have in Washington. That's why they call them rhinos. But this is specifically to reach out to good quality people, people that we agree with. We might not agree with everything doctrinally with them, but we agree on some of the basic principles and morality and righteousness. And they're trying to reach out that we have their ear. And if we can be as a force to be reckoned with there, then maybe we can change some things that take place on the, in the floor of Congress as well. But the battle's far from over, as Conley mentions there in his letter. And this is not the time to sit back and relax and be lulled to sleep, relishing the victory that we've just enjoyed. In fact, rather, we need to be ready, we need to be vigilant, and we need to be even more aggressive in our involvement in what's going on the political scene. That said, go to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. First, I submit to you this. We need to continue to be informed and engaged. Here in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, the apostle says this, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might." And there's some things here we'll come back to in a moment, but there's one aspect of this passage I want to point out. He says, "Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil," that you may be able to stand. That we need to take a stand. The time for the church to sit back and let somebody else take care of it or somebody else do it for us is past, folks. We need to stand. "For we wrestle not against," or verse 11, "put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." That's our responsibility, Christians. We need to stand and make our voice to be heard. I realize that there are more important things in the scheme of our lives than what goes on down in Washington. But the fact is that what takes place in Washington affects and sometimes hinders those other important things that we need to be doing. And so we need to be aware of and a part of what's going on down there. The enemy has been engaged for a long time. And even though they're a minority, they wield some power down there. The church needs to stand up. Christians need to stand up and to do what's right. There's many groups that are trying to energize and encourage. And I don't know how many of you voted. I'm hoping that all of you did. But if you didn't, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. These guys that stood up in the beginning of the service this morning to recognize them for the service that they perform for our country, to provide for us and preserve and protect the freedoms that we have in this nation of ours. You let them down if you didn't vote. To let your voice to be heard. That's a responsibility. It's more than just a right. It's a responsibility. We need to be involved. We need to let our voice to be heard. I was reading it was in Michigan, I believe it was a Senate race there. There was a candidate that was elected by 60 votes. Of over 840,000 votes cast, the decision came down to 60 votes. Of 84,000, 60 votes made the difference last Tuesday. There are 109 precincts in that Senate district. That means just a little more than half of those districts, if one person in less or a little more than half of those districts had voted different, it would have changed the face of that election. People say, "My vote doesn't count." Yeah, it does. Maybe it didn't count that much in Pennsylvania this year, but you don't know. It says the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is the Lord. You can make a difference. We have a responsibility. We need to write to our legislators, let them know what we expect of them. We need to let them know what's important to us. Keep their feet to the fire. Let them know that we're paying attention. Because you know what? I don't care who they are. They want to be reelected. And that's always in the back of their minds. And they're listening. As Brother Harding has said, one letter to them represents, in some cases, as many as 10,000 voices. Because they recognize that everybody doesn't always respond to a particular issue. So when they get a couple hundred letters on an issue, in their minds they're looking, okay, this is what I got. This represents maybe 200,000 voices. We need to let our voice be heard. Look at Proverbs 21:31. Proverbs chapter 21:31. Proverbs 21:31, the horse is prepared against the battle, but safety is of the Lord. Now, I believe that verse. I understand that the God's in charge of all of it. But don't miss what the first part of the verse says. The horse was prepared for the day of battle. There needs to be something done. We don't just say, oh, God's going to take care of it. I trust God. That's important. But so is the first part of the verse. You need to prepare the horse. That's our engagement. That's our involvement in what's going on in Washington, D.C. Number two, we need to recognize the nature of the battle. We saw Ephesians chapter 6 there. It says that, you know, the can't even quote it now. It escaped me. Ephesians 6. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. The battle is God's. Pull out a whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, and having done all to stand. We need to be strong in His strength. We need to trust in Him. We need to rely upon Him. We need to understand the nature of this battle. Because above all else, this is a spiritual conflict. Don't lose sight of that, folks. It says we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. It should be no surprise of some of the issues that we have to fight on. The idea that you could be required to have same-sex bathrooms, that's ridiculous. There's a spiritual battle taking place. Why should you be required to let your little girl go into a restroom? Some pervert might be in there. That's ridiculous. But it's more than just a mayor in Houston. It's at a higher level, folks. And we can't lose sight of that. Look at a couple of things here. You know, first, our nation was founded and built in the midst of a spiritual conflict. Our forefathers understood that. And prayer was a very important and a very integral part of all that they did in the writing of the Constitution and the founding of this country. But look at Daniel chapter 10 for a moment, if you would please. Daniel chapter 10. Daniel, of course, is writing as a captive in Babylon. He is risen to a power of position of influence and power in the kingdom there. But God's given him some insight. God's giving him some revelation of some things that are coming in the future. God's showing him what the powers are going to be that are going to raise up and conquer the Babylonians, and even after that, who's going to conquer them, and so forth. These things are things that God revealed to Daniel. In fact, I like to use this when somebody questions the authenticity of the Scriptures. They say, well, right there, look at that. That was written in about 400 or 500 B.C., before the Persian Empire, before the Greek-Roman Empire came to power. Yet they were mentioned there by Daniel. How could he know that? God gave it to him. Amen. There's prophecy revealed beforehand that can be proven to be fulfilled afterwards. It authenticates this book. But here's what Daniel gets. Start in verse 10. Well, read verse 1 and start there. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar, and the thing was true, but the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing and had understanding of the visions. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. And then he goes on and describes that and what led to this. Drop down to verse 10. And behold, as he gets this vision now, he's been fasting and praying for 3 weeks. He says, behold, an hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands. It put him down on his hands and knees. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright, for unto thee am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. This is kind of a frightening experience to him, this angel that comes to him with this message at this time. But he says, stand up, Daniel. We got a message for you in response to the prayer that you've made here. Verse 12, then said he unto me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. 3 weeks. He says, Daniel, when you started praying 3 weeks ago, we heard. And the answer was prepared and on its way. Watch this. Verse 13. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 1 in 20 days. But, lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. 3 weeks, something withstood the answer that Daniel was praying for, that was prepared and was being sent. And he mentions specifically the prince of the kingdom of Persia and Michael, one of the chief princes. Go over to chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. Verse 1. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even at that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Here's a prince that represents a nation. On Wednesday night we started the study of the book of Revelation. And we got into chapter 2 last Wednesday, and we were looking at the angels. In chapter 1, Jesus Christ is presented having these 7 angels in his hand, which are angels of the 7 churches mentioned in chapter 2 and chapter 3 of Revelation. Those angels are representatives of a church. The suggestion is that Grace Baptist Church has an angel in heaven that represents us before the Father. Here we see that nations have an angel. Michael, the prince, is an angel representing the nation of Israel before God the Father. Go to Jude and verse 9. Jude and verse 9. He talks about Sodom and Gomorrah and the wickedness there. And then he goes down to verse 9. He says, "Yet Michael the archangel." In Daniel, he is called the prince of the people of Israel. Here he's called the archangel. "When contending with the devil, he disputed about the body of Moses, durst not bring against him a railing accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke thee.'" What do you see here? A conflict between Michael the archangel and Satan over the body of Moses. Now, there's a lot more that we're not even going to get into regarding that this morning, but the important thing to see is who Michael is and what he is. He's not just a man. He represents the nation of Israel before God. Look at Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 7. "And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Michael's doing some battle. He did it back in the time of Daniel. As that message was prepared, the answer to Daniel's prayer, but it was delayed 3 weeks, 21 days, by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Satan withstood him. Here, battle is taking place in heaven. Michael and his angels against the dragon and his angels. Folks, it's more than just what we see here. There is a spiritual battle that is being waged. There's a guy named Frank Peretti. Some of you may be familiar with him. He wrote some books, This Present Darkness and Piercing the Darkness. And again, I may not completely agree with all of his theology, but the one thing that I believe he does is illustrates in a way that many of us may not think of the spiritual warfare that is taking place around us. You want a glimpse of that thing? Go to 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6. Elisha is facing a difficult situation. And they seem to be greatly outnumbered. He's got a servant along with him there. And it says this in verse 17 of 2 Kings chapter 6. "And Elisha prayed and said, 'Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes,'" that is the eyes of his servant, "'that he may see.' And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha." This servant, young man, traveling with Elisha, not fully understanding some things yet. The battle that we face on a spiritual level, much higher, you know, that the principality, the power, the rulers of the darkness of this world, the spiritual wickedness in high places. He says, open his eyes so he can see it. And he does, and he sees the hosts of heaven that are up there on their side fighting in that battle. And ultimately giving them the victory. And Christians, we don't always take this into consideration with what's going on here. It's not just about Barack Obama being our president and Harry Reid being in charge of the Senate. It's much higher than that. They're just pawns. They're just tools in the hand of a greater power. And it's not the Illuminati or the CFR or the Trilateral Commission or any of the other organizations that supposedly pull the strings in the world. It's Satan himself. If those organizations are of any influence, it's only because Satan's pulling their strings too. And too often times we get focused on the wrong enemy. It's not Democrat. It's not Republican. It's spiritual. We need to understand the nature of the battle, folks. We look at the issues, homosexuality, abortion, morality, righteousness, judgment. Those are the battles that we're fighting today. Who sets those standards? God. Who's opposed to those standards? Satan. And he's using his tools to try to defeat us. Jeremiah chapter 9. Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 24. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Here's another thing we maybe get a little bit messed up. Does God care about America? Be careful how you answer that. Let me rephrase it. Is America important to God's plan and purpose? It's not about America. This is what's important to God. Loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight, saith the Lord. It's not about God wanting to preserve America. It's the people, the righteous people in America, that God wants to preserve. And that's where I think some get off course. It's not about just preserving America. It's about preserving God's holy standard. And God will use any country that will honor Him. That's what made America special, is we chose to honor God. We chose God as our God. But if God chose the nation of Israel Himself, and if He took the nation of Israel and wiped them out and allowed them to be conquered and destroyed, why couldn't He do the same with America? When we depart from His holy standard. It's not about preserving America, folks. It's about preserving that which God values. And if we do that, then God will preserve America. But sometimes we make America too important, more important than it is in God's eyes. Psalm 33. Psalm chapter 33, verse 5. He loveth righteousness and judgment. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. Chapter 45 and verse 7. Thou lovest righteousness and hatest wickedness. Therefore God, thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. You see, it's not Republican or Democrat. You know, there's some godly Democrats out there. There's some ungodly Republicans out there. It's about the righteousness and the judgment. That's what God's looking for. Proverbs 16 and verse 12. Proverbs 16, 12. It is an abomination to kings to commit wickedness, for the throne is established by righteousness. That's what God's looking at. Not the letter after his name, but the content of his character. And Proverbs 14, verse 34. Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. I'm registered as a Republican, but only so I can vote in the primary, so I can have a voice. There's a lot of things, you know, there's some good things going on now, but there's a lot of things I don't agree with and like about the Republican Party. Or maybe, and I'm finding out this more and more, there's the Republican Party, and then there are the Republican establishment. Those two are not necessarily one and the same. It's the establishment that's entrenched in office and makes the appointments to the committees and so forth in the halls of Congress. And they don't always listen to what or agree with where the party stands. The party's more in tune with us right now. The establishment Republicans are not. They're the ones that need to hear. But at the same time, remember, it's a battle far above just John McCain and Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and Lindsey Graham and some of these other knuckleheads. God's in control. We need to recognize the battle. And we need to use the appropriate weapons. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Second Corinthians 10 and verse 3. For we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. Once we understand what the battle is, then we need to make use of the appropriate weapons. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Our weapons. Because as Ephesians 6 said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And a knife, or a pistol, or an AR-15, or a hand grenade, or an atomic bomb is of absolutely no value in that battle. It's meaningless. God's given us some weapons. 2 Timothy chapter 2. I'm sorry, that should be 1 Timothy 2. Nope. Yeah, yes, 1 Timothy 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. That's the greatest weapon we have, to pray for our president, Barack Obama, to pray for his salvation, to pray that God will remove him if he won't bend, to pray for the majority leader in the Senate, the majority leader in the House, the minority leader in the Senate, the minority leader in the House, to pray for our congressmen and our senators, to pray for our governor. That's our responsibility, folks. That's the weapon that God has put at our disposal. And you know what? We do a lot of talk about prayer and a lot less praying. We meet tonight at 6 o'clock. There'll be a short devotion. These requests from this morning will be repeated. Any others to be added will be given. And then we'll pray. There ought to be more people at prayer meeting. That's a time to do business with God about the needs here. Well, I can pray at home. Yes, you can. But you know what? The early church prayed together. Yeah, they prayed individually at home. But there was a time when they came together for prayer as well. It's part of God's plan and purpose for the church. And you decide. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, every time I decide I'm going to talk to this person about something, then I end up finding out that they had a legitimate reason why they weren't here. Between you and God. But that's what our purpose is on Sunday night, is to pray. Pray for one another. Pray for our country. To do business on this spiritual level where the real battle takes place. With Beth Reese going for the doctor's appointment on Thursday. With Pat, unspoken requests and some situations with her daughter in her home. With Micah, the polyps that have developed in his colon. With Geralee expecting these twins. And on and on and on the list goes. And for kings. And for all that are in authority, we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. It's not about preserving America. It's about preserving us. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, is what it says in verse 3 of 1 Timothy chapter 2. We've got a responsibility, folks. We need to be engaged. We need to understand the level of the battle. We need to use the weapons that God has placed at our disposal. Let's stand, please, for prayer. Lord, help us. God, help us to be fully aware of what we're facing. The level of the conflict. Too often times we have our sights set too low. Help us to see, God, at what level this battle is being fought. And then to properly engage that enemy. Over there in Jude, it said, Michael, the archangel, did not personally oppose Satan, but said, the Lord rebuke him. God, it's not in our power, but in your strength that we can have victory in these battles. God, I thank you for those who are elected, the men like Tim Scott and the Ernst woman there and a number of others, Trey Gowdy being reelected and some good quality individuals, God, that I believe stand for righteousness and therefore are pleasing in your sight. God, help them not to be defiled by the party politics that take place once they get to Washington. God, help us to keep engaged as well. To be ever vigilant for the battle that is before us. That we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. That our children after us may be able to live a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. God, help us to fight the battles that are before us to fight, but to do so in your strength. In Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen.